Welcome to the Crosslands Church podcast. Our mission, to help you experience the life with God you've been missing. And now, a message for you.
I want to begin today with a quote that comes from somebody named A.W. Tozer, who wrote this sometime in the last century. He said this: "What comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us." I wonder what you think of that statement. Is that true or isn't it? I mean, probably most of us don't think about God as much as we'd like to think that we do, and when we do think about God, we don't think much about what we think about God or how we think about God. We have all kinds of ideas about God, and I remember when I was young, I grew up in a family where my parents were, they would have considered themselves new followers of Jesus, and so there was a certain intensity in that that was interesting, I'll say that. So I'm old enough that I remember the 1970s, and in the 1970s, there was a really popular thing. They had these little booklets that were kind of comic book style that were meant to be handed to somebody and explain the story of Jesus. And the most popular of those was called This Is Your Life. And it told the story about somebody that lived his life and had opportunities to submit his life to God, and he didn't. And at the end of time, he stood before the great throne of judgment, and God basically showed his entire life on a widescreen movie. And that idea, I never liked that idea, because it's not just about everybody watching all the wrong things you do, but it's like they see the embarrassing things you do, right? I understand that Jesus died to forgive my sins, but not to erase the times I fell and made an idiot of myself or whatever, right? But there's this idea in this comic, this tract, they call them, that your life will be, you know, aired for everybody to see, good, bad, ugly. And the idea, the image of God in this tract is what stuck with me, because it shows God as this faceless giant on a throne. And I think that's probably my earliest image of what I would think that God would look like. And it's probably, you know, buried in me somewhere, informing everything I think of God all the time. God is the faceless giant on the throne that's going to judge me one day. And you may have your own. I mean, there's all kinds of ideas that people might have about who's your basic idea of God. Is he a scrutinizing judge? Is he an angry father figure? I think for a lot of people, their earliest idea of who God is comes from their idea of who their father is, whether that's loving and encouraging or angry and abusive or absent and non-existent. Somebody was telling me this past week that their idea of God used to be a bald cartoon Mr. Clean type guy, whatever that means. You might think of God as a bearded Santa-like figure that gives you what you want when you want it and when you need it. As long as you're good enough, you know, he's checking the list twice, whether you're naughty or nice. Some people think that God is some kind of impersonal force, a manifestation of the universe, right? That you can leverage if you do things correctly. You can align your energy with or whatever. And some people see the idea of God as completely obsolete, has no place in the world today. And other people see the idea of God as a powerful symbol without a real referent, without pointing to somebody or something that's real. It's an idea that guides us and drives us forward. So I want to talk about this today, this question of who is God? How are we supposed to imagine him or perceive him? And before we do that, I want to just do a couple of quick little announcements. The first one is we have a youth discipleship team that's going on a mission trip this summer, and we had a dessert auction last night. It was a lot of fun. Spent way too much on dessert and ate way too much dessert. But the people that were there bid a lot of money for some really good desserts and raised a total of $2,250 towards that. So we're really excited about that. Not just for the money raised, but for this life-changing experience that some of our youth are going to be going on. We have a discipleship group that Mariah is leading, and just a few of those are going to be doing the trip. But the other people in the discipleship group are also supporting the team, and they helped, like the whole discipleship group, I think, helped run the fundraiser last night. And you may be thinking, maybe you missed out last night. And I have to tell you, you did. Because it was a lot of fun, and it was a lot of dessert. But you still have an opportunity to participate by donating to the team. So if you want to give to that, you can, if you're giving online or at the debit station, if you give online, there's a drop-down box that says Youth Discipleship Trip. You can give there. And there were a couple of desserts, I don't want to say left over, there were a couple of desserts that were held back last night. There are a couple of really, really nice looking cakes. And so we have them out in the lobby, and we're doing like a silent auction. So you can bid on that. And I don't want to put any pressure on anyone, but I think the most expensive cake that went last night went for $260. But no pressure. I'm not saying you have to beat that. You can. But that's out there. Have a look afterwards. I have no idea what it's up to after this morning service, but you guys have the last dibs on that. So if you don't bid, you lose the cake. Could be yours. I also want to talk about some of our next steps at Crossings. This is something we talk about fairly regularly. There are ways to grow and move forward in your spiritual journey. And if you're a regular here at Crossings Church, the one I want to talk about this morning is baptism. So we had an open house service last week where we invited people to follow Jesus for the first time. Actually, we do that every week. But if you have decided to follow Jesus, if you've never been water baptized, this is something that is it's commanded in the Bible. It's kind of a it's an outward demonstration of your spiritual life. And so we do a baptism service here at Crossings Church kind of whenever there's enough people that want to be baptized. And so we did one fairly recently, but we'd love to do another one again. So if you have never been baptized and you want to, go onto crosslands.live, and there's a box there that says be baptized. And just fill in your contact information, and we'll get a hold of you to try to see if we can get enough people to do another service. So with that, we're in our current series, the Cross series. And when we started the series, it was a couple of months ago, I think, and I talked about how the crucifixion of Jesus is the center of who we are as a community of followers of Jesus. It's the central identity marker for our lives. It's where the center of our meaning and understanding is. But there's a whole lot of meaning and understanding there. I kind of compared it at the beginning to like a gemstone that has many facets. And so these messages are not in chronological order because there is no chronological order for this. But we're looking at various facets, and you'll find the light from one facet will bleed into another as we look at it from different angles. And you'll see a little bit of overlap there. And I'm starting to realize it's also like a puzzle where all the pieces kind of interlock. And so hopefully this morning, if you've been tracking with us for a few weeks, you'll see that there's more here this morning. There's some overlap from the past, but we're just exploring this at a deeper and deeper level. We do have message notes for today on crosslands.live. If you go onto that as well, there's where do we go from here questions in the, I think it's Sunday morning message is what the box is. And we should have time at the end to entertain text messages. If you have a comment or question relevant to the message today, my number will be on the top of the screen. It actually already is. And you can text me, and we'll deal with those. So, the quote I gave you at the beginning, what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. It's part of a broader quote. And I want to read the whole thing this morning from A.W. Tozer. What comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. The history of mankind will probably show that no people has ever risen above its religion, and man's spiritual history will positively demonstrate that no religion has ever been greater than its idea of God. Worship is pure or base as the worshiper entertains high or low thoughts of God. Now, it's a nice thought, it's a nice concept. Just because he said it and just because I repeat it doesn't make it true. And I want to kind of explore, is that really true? Is it really true that what you think about God is the most important thing about you? And at some level, I ask the question, how do we know anything about God at all? And what you know about God may come from what people have told you. It may come from something you've read in a book or many books. It may have come from your own experience. I want to start by talking about what we've thought about God kind of in our culture. Maybe cultures, maybe our society as a whole. And I just want to, there's probably a whole lot of avenues we can look at. I just want to address four. First one is science. And this is fairly recent, like past couple hundred years. Science tells us that, at least the extreme end of science, tells us that what is true is what can be measured. And since we can't measure God, he either doesn't exist or he's irrelevant. Because we can't measure him. Again, it's a relatively new concept. The history of religion has the idea that our religious ideas evolve. So you can imagine that, this is what they tell us, that ancient man was sitting under the sky at night and a thunderstorm came by and lightning and thunder and all of that. And they said, how do we understand this? How do we explain this? And what we do as human beings, we tend to personify things around us, right? You know, when you have a flat tire, who did this to me? The universe is out to get me, right? And maybe it's just a flat tire. So we had a flat tire the other day, and so I took it into the shop, and they fixed it, but I texted Michelle and said, there was a nail in it. And she said, oh, I wonder how that happened. And I said, somebody probably drove over a nail. Anyway, we got it fixed. But it wasn't the universe out to get us, right? It's not personified. But the idea is that ancient man looked up and ascribed personality to thunder and lightning, and that became actual personified gods, deities. So there's the god of thunder, god of lightning, like Thor and all of that. And as our religious belief grew and people thought about it more deeply, there's this idea, well, if you have a whole bunch of gods, well, who's the strongest one? So you have a polytheism where there's a god in charge. And then the idea arose, well, the absolute highest god, there's actually only one god. All the other ones don't really exist. There's one highest god. And we went through polytheism through to monotheism to deism, where, you know, some creator kicked off the universe but doesn't really interact with us because God is so high above us. And that very quickly moved into atheism as people found natural explanations for stuff. So that's what history of religion tells us, correctly or incorrectly. Then there's mysticism. People have had experiences where they experience God, or they experience some kind of deity, and they experience this directly, beyond what we can understand. I experience this, I can't explain this, and it's within a cultural context where they tend to understand their mystical experience based on what their current cultural religion is. So mysticism has taught people things that they believe about God. And then philosophy, and this is a big one, because I think this impacts us more than we know. Our in the West, our philosophical roots come from Greece. And they came to the conclusion at a certain point that God is so far, so high above us, because he has certain characteristics, like he's omniscient, that means he knows everything. He's omnipotent, that means he is all-powerful. He is omnipresent, means he's everywhere. And he's eternal, he's in all time, right? And partner with that the idea that if for God to be God, he's completely unchanging. There's this God somewhere up, far up, high, behind, whatever, that's inaccessible. So what we know about God, we can kind of guess around the edges, but he's the ultimate in power, honor, and glory, and all of that stuff, really, I think, because those were the highest values in the culture of the day. Power, honor, glory. You read some of the oldest texts like Homer, the story of Achilles, and the striving for honor was the preeminent value and goal. That you would accumulate enough honor that your name would live on. There's a couple problems with that idea, that God is so high, far removed, all-powerful, that, first of all, if God has expectations of us, and it would be reasonable to assume that he does, because he wouldn't create for no reason. If God is a creator who created us and has expectations, but he's so far removed, how could we possibly know what those expectations are? That's the first problem. The second problem is quite a bit different, is that people would speak for God, and people still speak for God today. I am God's voice in the world, and people that speak on behalf of God directly have caused a lot of problems in the world. You wouldn't have 9/11 people crashing planes into the towers. They said, God told us to do this. And how do you argue against that? It's a problem. When I was younger, when we had young kids, so they would probably be 3, 4, 4 and 5, and I would play hide and seek with them. And 3 and 4 year old kids, they're not that smart. So I could win every time. Suckers. They can't find me. No, but the point of hide and seek is not really to win, because the ultimate winner is never found. Have you ever won a game of hide and seek and everybody goes and does something else because you're just so good? That's not a lot of fun. The point of hide and seek, especially with your kids, is to be found by them. That's the point for young kids. Right? I'm not going to play super competitive. So I would hide in the shower, right? They'd have no clue. Close the shower curtain, and they'd be running around and And Michelle would be telling, go find daddy. And they'd walk right in the bathroom and walk right out. And it's like, it starts getting boring because I'm not getting found. So I'd start making noises like, whoop, hey, like that, right? And they'd be running around trying to find me. And they'd walk right in the bathroom again, not see me, and walk right out. They just wouldn't think of looking in the shower. Until I had to keep doing it so much they could find me. And yay, you found daddy. And so that's kind of the story of God. God desires to be found. There's an old argument that suggests that God is like a clockmaker who wound up the universe like a clock and let it go. Almost like we're some kind of experiment, like mold in a petri dish. But the story of the Bible, okay, and that's kind of where I'm coming from. I hope that's not a surprise to anyone. The story of the Bible fundamentally is that God wants to reveal himself to creation and to specifically to the humans that he created. You see that from the beginning. He creates Adam and Eve in the garden. He relates with them. He engages with them. He reveals himself again to Noah, to Job, to Moses, to all of his people, Israel, when he has his chosen nation. He reveals himself to them. And increasingly, as they continue to fail and walk away, that's his purpose. And the highest revelation that we understand of God is Jesus himself. And so I want to look at a passage today. It's in Philippians that describes what this is about. So we're in the cross series. And the understanding that Jesus is the revelation of God, it isn't just about Jesus who walks around doing miracles and attracting people and feeding people with loaves and fishes and calming the storm and all of that. The highest revelation of God is Jesus, but not just Jesus doing miracles, Jesus showing compassion, but Jesus on the cross. That's the highest revelation of God. And so we'll see this in the book of Philippians. This is a letter that Paul wrote to one of the earliest churches, to a city, a church in a city called Philippi that had kind of special status. They were Roman citizens by virtue of living there. If you were born in Philippi, you were automatically a Roman citizen. And here's why that was the case. Because Rome believed they understood the best way to live in the world. They had the ideal life, and they wanted to spread that to everybody. And if somebody didn't agree with their ideas, they still wanted to spread it, so they would do it at the point of a sword. And if you really didn't agree, they'd kill you, and if they didn't kill you, they would enslave you. And in order to keep this going, they had to spread farther and farther and farther. They need bigger and bigger armies, and they would either capture people to be slaves or capture people to be soldiers and build their army further. Problem is that you end up with a whole lot of soldiers, and when they retire, you don't want them living in Rome. You don't want psychologically scarred people from that you've captured from Germany or Ethiopia or whatever, and you take a whole bunch of bored people who are used to being violent and living in Rome. So what they'd say, you can be a Roman citizen, we'll find a city for you somewhere else. We'll give you land. You are now a Roman citizen. You own land. And Philippi was one of those cities. So by virtue of living there, most of them had been, or the people that kind of started the city were retired soldiers that acknowledged that Caesar was Lord. Because we live in the Roman Empire. Caesar's in charge. Caesar is Lord. Those are the people that Paul is writing to. But some of them had become followers of Jesus. And they were experiencing some kind of division and competition in the church. And so that's part of the purpose of him writing the letter. And what he writes in here, the part that we're going to read, is understood by many scholars to be one of the oldest Christian texts we have. Because it's older than the letter. It's almost like Paul is taking a well-known Christian song and putting it into the letter to help make his point. So it would have been a song that would have been probably passed along orally that contained some of the very oldest ideas of who Jesus was. So I'm going to read. Let's start with Philippians 2, verses 6 to 8. I'll start at verse 5, because Paul's addressing an issue. You must have the same attitude that Christ Jesus had. Verse 6, this song starts. Though he was God, talking about Jesus, he did not think of equality with God as something to cling to. Instead, he gave up his divine privileges, he took the humble position of a slave, and was born as a human being. When he appeared in human form, he humbled himself in obedience to God and died a criminal's death on a cross. So I'm reading that out of the New Living Translation, and we like this translation because it's very accessible. It's very easy to read and understand what's being said. But anytime there's translation from one language to another, it's hard to get it exactly right because no language directly translates. And so some of the concepts can get missed. And I don't love the way this part was translated. And so you can compare it with other translations. But there's some key bits in here. When it says in verse 6, though he was God, the actual original wording would be something along the lines of being in the form of God. So if you were to read that as a skeptic, you would say, well, it's not saying that Jesus is God at all. It's saying he looks like God. He's in the form of God. If you ever had to suffer through high school philosophy, anybody ever had to take that? Yeah, it sucks. But they all start with Plato, okay, that old Greek philosopher. And he had this idea that there's an ideal form of things. For every thing that you see or interact with, there's an ideal version of that. I don't know whether he meant conceptual or actually real in some realm. And it's kind of like this. It's kind of like if you go see a movie, you come out and you say it was a good movie or it was a bad movie. Well, compared to what? Well, compared to your ideal of what a movie should be. So you have this kind of unexplored idea somewhere in the back of your head that says, a perfect movie is, you know, I laughed, I cried, I was excited, had me on the edge of my seat, the right superheroes didn't die. Oh, sorry. I don't want to give any spoilers away. Avengers. But you come out and you go, that was a good movie. And there may be different kinds of good movies. Maybe there's a good rom-com, right? And then maybe there's a good action movie and a good sci-fi movie. But a good movie, you're comparing it to some unknown ideal. And so Plato said, those ideals, we call them forms. Okay, and that's the exact word that's being used here. When he says, being in the very form of God, and what I think is being said in this song, because this is a lot closer to Platonic philosophy than we would be today, is there's an ideal of who God is, and that's Jesus. Being in the very form of God. In the world they lived in, I already mentioned that, you know, you had all these people that appealed, that understood that Caesar was Lord. And there was this idea that Caesar himself was a representative of Rome's ideals. In fact, there was an idea that ever since Augustus, that when the emperor died, he actually became a god. He was elevated to god status. That was around this time. After that, he was a god actually in his lifetime. But at this point, when he dies, there was a word. The word was apotheosis. At death, he becomes a god. Apotheosis. Godhood is conferred upon him. And all of that, the glory and the honor that goes with being a god is given to Caesar. And they would have temples to Caesar and so on. In contrast, when it talks about Jesus, it says, instead he gave up his divine privileges. The original language there says something along the lines of he emptied himself. And the Greek word, the noun version of that emptied, is kenosis, which is the opposite of apotheosis. It's not taking on godhood, it's emptying yourself of godhood. So there's a complete reversal there. So being in the form of God, he did not think of equality with God as something to cling to. And I like the way they translated that, because the idea is something to grab onto or hold onto, something to cling to. So he didn't do that. Instead, he gave up. He emptied himself of his godhood. He took the humble position of a slave. Okay, translation error, not error, translation issue there. Because the humble position of a slave is he took the form of a slave. So there's that concept again. Now he's gone from ideal of what a deity is, of what a god is, to an ideal of what a slave is. That's a pretty big deal. And then it goes on, and was born as a human being when he appeared in human form. Oh, they left the word in there, being human form. So now he's this ideal human. And that's a big concept in Scripture, something that we tend to miss. Because there's this idea that Adam was created as the ideal human from which the human race comes from, but everything got screwed up, and Jesus comes as the new ideal human. But the ideal human is not godlike. He's emptied himself of that and become the perfect servant or the perfect slave. That's what it means to be perfectly human. That's it. That's an incredible concept in that culture where honor and glory were the highest values. In fact, we wouldn't even value humility if it wasn't for Christianity's influence on our culture. I find it funny when people give a speech at the Academy Awards or something like that. They accept their award and they say, I'm honored and humbled to receive this. What? Those are opposite things. Like, they're exact opposites. Humble and humility and humiliation are very, very close together. Nobody strives for humiliation, but that's very close to what being humble means. To be honored and to be humbled are opposite things. Now, I know why people do that. You know, I'm honored to be here. I don't really deserve it because I'm humble. And so they're kind of wrapping it all together. And some people say, I'm not sure we value humility so much in our culture. Like we say we do. Yeah, we do. Because when somebody shows false humility, we have a huge distaste for that. They pretend to be humble, but they're not. We actually value humility, but they did not in this culture. Humility and humiliation are the same thing. So here's Jesus not holding on to what it means to be, what they would understand it means to be God, becoming the perfect slave, the perfect human. And nobody would have thought that that would have been perfect to be a human, to be a slave. It's not good to be a slave. He humbled himself in obedience to God and died a criminal's death on a cross. And we've talked about that quite a bit over the past few weeks, what it means, what crucifixion means, that crushing of a person, the humiliation of a person, the elimination of all honor. Now, there's one more transitional area issue I want to bring up, and that's in the very first sentence, though he was God. And I looked at this in numerous translations, and about half of them say, though he was God, and about the other half say, being God. The original translation is being God. And I think I know why it was translated, though, because we don't understand, because our default position of God is the omnis, omnipresent, omnipotent, omniscient. He knows everything. He's everywhere. He's all-powerful. That's our default understanding of what God is. When I was in youth group and we did a discipleship course and we brought up the subject, who is God? That's where they started. All-powerful, all-knowing, everywhere, eternal. When I was in Bible college, that's where we started. Who's God? All-powerful, all-knowing, everywhere, and eternal. That's the very definition of God. And we can't understand. We've been so influenced by that high school level Platonic philosophy that that's our starting point. That's not the Bible's starting point. It's not the Bible's starting point. The word though does not appear in the text. This blew my mind. I became a follower of Jesus at the age of 5. I started Bible college in 1994. I came across this concept about 3 months ago, and it blew my mind, and I hope it blows your mind today too. Why did Jesus humble himself? He humbled himself because he was God. Not in spite of the fact that he was God. He humbled himself because he's God. Because God's primary characteristic in the Bible is not all-powerful, all-knowing, everywhere, and eternal. His primary characteristic is a loving creator who works in history to reach his people, to redeem his people. That's who he is. You want to know the core of who God is, of who God's personality is. It's self-giving, loving creator who would become humble to achieve his ends. What does God look like? Like a man on a cross. What does God's personality look like? He's not a giant, faceless judge on a throne. He's a man on a cross who would go that far to demonstrate his love and rescue the people he loves. That's a huge concept. I mean, it blows my mind today. I have no idea what they would have thought about it 2,000 years ago. I'm going to go on. Therefore, God elevated him to the place of highest honor. Now, this will mess with your mind, and I haven't figured this out. Okay, so here's God on the cross, and God elevates him. Who's doing what where? So there's this idea that, but the idea is that God himself goes all the way to the bottom, to the worst possible place you could go, which is on the cross, the place of humiliation, the place of defeat, to death. But through that, he becomes elevated to the highest honor. It says, and God gave him the name above all other names, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven, on earth, under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. All of that last part was completely ripped off from a part in Isaiah in the Old Testament, where God himself, the creator of the universe, the all-powerful creator of the universe, who reveals himself to Israel by the name Yahweh, says, I am Yahweh, there's no other like me, no other has my name, and only at my name and at no other name will every knee bow and every tongue confess. And here, that's described to Jesus himself. Jesus is God himself who demonstrates the character of God through self-giving love, humiliation, and that's how he achieves his aims, and that's how we recognize that he's the Lord of the universe, because the way Caesar operates is through the sword. through power, through domination. But ultimately, what wins is self-giving love, service. That's what wins. That's what resurrection brings about. It wasn't so much that God just raised Jesus from the dead and brought him back to life to say, yes, he's really the Messiah. He raised Jesus to the highest place. He went all the way to the bottom, all the way to the top, because the way to the top is by going the way to the bottom. And this is our path. He's not just the person we worship, but he's the person we follow. And so the next couple of verses, dear friends, he's writing back to the song's over, he's writing to the Philippians, you've always followed my instructions when I was with you, and now that I'm away, it's even more important. Work hard to show the results of your salvation. I grew up with a translation that was, work out your salvation in fear and trembling. And like, what does that mean? Because we're not supposed to work for our salvation. And I think what it is it's talking about that internal battle that says, don't let your pride get in the way of following Jesus. Don't let your pride keep you from following in Jesus' footsteps all the way to the bottom, because ultimately one day it'll be all the way to the top. Obeying God with deep reverence and fear, for God is working in you. God's the one that's doing it. God is the one that puts the motives and the desires into your heart, giving you the desire and the power to do what pleases him. These early Christians, these early followers of Jesus that lived in Philippi, they had all kinds of rights that they could appeal to being Roman citizens. Paul says the rights of your citizenship in heaven trump those. And you know, I find we're the same in Canada, right? You can't do that to me. You can't talk to me that way. I'm a Canadian citizen. Yeah, but you're a Christian first. The rights that are conferred on you from heaven are completely different, because part of that is the right and the responsibility to follow Jesus' footsteps, to be completely self-giving and serving others. That's not rights. It's not. And we really struggle with that because we want power. We want a voice. I'm not saying we shouldn't have a voice in our culture, but the voice should be very different from what many people have heard. Here's a quote. Actually, I want to talk. Like last week, there was an issue where there was multiple bombings in Sri Lanka, and they were targeting Christian churches. And a whole bunch of people died. And people of prominence spoke out against that, but they didn't say Christians. They said Easter worshippers, as if it's like kind of bad to be a Christian, because you wouldn't say that about any other religion. And it kind of is. Christianity is, have you ever felt kind of uncomfortable when you tell someone you're a Christian because you're worried about how they might perceive that? Oh, so you believe in the Crusades? Well, no, that's not what I'm saying. Oh, so you hate other religions? No, that's not what I'm saying. There's perceptions of Christianity. There's perceptions of what Christianity represents that are completely wrong. And that comes down to what people think of God and what you think of God. Here's a quote from a man named J.D. Meyer, wrote this. One primary reason that Christians are perceived by many in the world today as mean, hateful, bigoted, rude, and angry is because we are unconsciously reflecting a view of the crucifixion that contains a mean, hateful, bigoted, rude, and angry God in the background. Ouch. How we think of God informs how we think of ourselves and how we think of other people. I want to read this, and I don't want to get it wrong, so I copied this out of a study that I just came across. It was a recent study in the United States. It says this: psychologists asked more than 500 U.S. Christians how they perceived God using a new technique. The researchers showed participants hundreds of paired faces and asked the subjects to select the one that looked more like God. By combining the selected faces, the researchers created a composite face of God that reflected each of the participants' choices. So they did this first, and then they put them online, an online platform. They had 400 people rate the images on 9 dimensions, such as age, gender, and intelligence. And the results showed that these U.S. Christians tended to view God as young, Caucasian, and loving. How do you view God? Young, Caucasian, and loving. Now, there's a difference between liberals and conservatives. So liberals saw God as more feminine, more African-American, and more loving than conservatives did. Conservatives picked faces that were perceived as older, more intelligent, and more powerful, the researchers said. And here's the problem with that. I think the biggest theological problem we have in our North American society today is that we view God, we see him as looking like us. I don't just mean face. I mean, you might, God doesn't look like me. You might think that God looks like me, okay? He doesn't. I don't even have a beard. No, it's not about the physical appearance. But we, when we think of God, we think that he likes what we like. We think that he overlooks what we overlook. And we think that he deems important what we deem important. My brother used to criticize the WWJD bracelet movement, right? What would Jesus do? And he says, people wear those bracelets. They think, what they really mean is, what would I do? Because if Jesus was in my exact circumstance, he would do exactly what I would do. Really? Our problem is that we think that God looks like us. We associate like me with good. And that's why we have an us versus them mentality when people come from other cultures. And we think, well, they're not like me, so they can't be good. God doesn't look like me. God doesn't look like us. God doesn't love like us. Seeing correctly changes the way we relate to God. Seeing correctly changes the way we perceive ourselves in the sight of God. What are your thoughts of God? Seeing correctly changes the way we interact with one another. Seeing the way God sees changes the way we interact with people that are not Christians. And I think it's very different from our default position sometimes, where we just assume that God looks and thinks the way we do. What comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. How do you overcome that? Subject your opinions to his. Subject your thoughts to his thoughts. Subject your image, your idea of God, to Christ on the cross, that complete, ultimate self-giving love for others, that he would become the ideal human, the ideal slave. That's why we read scripture, to overcome our own thoughts with God's thoughts. That's why we pray, not just to talk to God, but to listen to him and let his thoughts inform our thoughts. Now, maybe you're here today and you have thoughts of God that have kept you from following him because you've seen him as an abusive, angry dad, or you've seen him as a huge, faceless judge on a throne, or a mystical force with no personality, with no person. But you have an opportunity to follow him, to follow who he really is, to live the life that he has for you. And how do you do that? It's as simple as ABC. A, admit your need for him. My thoughts of you have been wrong. I didn't know that you loved me that much and that you have a life that's better. B, believe that he has a life that you can live that's made possible through Jesus' death and resurrection. And C, commit your life to him, completely to him. Because you can't live the old life and the new life at the same time. This is an entry point into a whole new life, committing to becoming a follower of Jesus. And this is what we do at Crossland Church. We strive to follow Jesus. Commit to the community here or another community that truly follows Jesus. And if you want to do that today, and it's the most important decision you'll ever make, go into crossness.live, and click follow Jesus. Give us your contact information, because it is the start of a whole new life, and we want to help you with that, because it's something that we do together. I'm going to close in a second. I'm already over time. So, one text message. So, what did you think about the movie The Shack? Yeah, it was all right. Was it a good movie? Depends what you mean by good. I wouldn't say it was a good action movie. Was it a good theological movie? I don't know. It's a great conversation starter, The Shack, if you haven't seen it. It's a great conversation starter because it'll. I presume that the question has more to do with it than that, because the book and the movie show God, depict God as Trinitarian, so three persons in one. And so you have the Spirit, who's very spirity. The Spirit was played by a woman, and I don't know how to describe that. Almost like a hippie elf, maybe. If you watch the movie, you know what I mean. Okay, so the Son was played by somebody that looks like Jesus with a beard. Very kind. But God the Father was played by a black woman. And people had a lot of problems with that. But you know who I don't think would have had problems with that? People who were raised with an abusive father. All of a sudden, there's this possibility that the man that you feared that destroyed your life, maybe God's not like that. Maybe God's more like the lady from Touched by an Angel. You'd have to be old enough to recognize that. But warm, open, friendly, strong, determined, has better for you, not willing to settle for you to be the same as you are because there's better for you, but not angry and abusive. And so people had problems with the movie. People had problems with the story. I don't know that I did. You know, it's a book. You know which book gets it right? I mean, you know which book that's not the Bible gets it right? None of them. So there you go. Take what you can from it. Let's stand. We're going to close the service in prayer. Sorry we went over time. When the service is done, okay, we turn Theater One into a prayer room, and I know that there are people here that need to have your idea of God reshaped. Allow God to reshape it. Stay in Theater One, 20 minutes, half an hour, whatever. Let God speak to you and reform what your image of him is. Because there's all kinds of distortions that will distort the way you see him. It'll distort your relationship with him. It'll distort your relationship with other people. We always challenge people to have a meaningful conversation with one another, particularly with somebody you've never met before, because this is a place for us to belong and to relate to one another. We need to be warm and welcoming. Just ask that you do that in the lobby, not in Theater One, so that this can be that prayer room and we can allow people to engage with God. You can pray by yourself. You can pray with a spouse or a family member or with people from your small group or somebody you don't know. There are people that will be here that are willing to pray for you. If you want someone to pray for you, just raise your hand and somebody will come over and pray with you. But let me pray for you now before we close. Father, I thank you that you are a God who loves. And Father, I pray that this week you would adjust the way we see you. Father, whatever distorted images of you we carry in our head that inform our relationship with you, inform our actions, inform our goals and values, Father, I pray that you would bring correction to that when we strive to understand who you are, the starting point would be Jesus on the cross, who gave himself for us because you love us so much. And Father, give us the ability, the willingness to follow in your footsteps, to be willing to act in humility towards one another, towards others, to act with your love. Father, fill us with your love, that we would understand how much you love us, and give us so much that it would just overflow, that we couldn't hold it in. I ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen.
You've been listening to the Crosslands Church podcast. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes or the Google Play Store so that it comes straight to your device. And to find out more about Crosslands Church, you can visit us at crosslands.ca. Join us next week for another message to help you experience the life with God you've been missing.